Welcome. You're listening to the Mac Observer's Background Mode. This is your host, John Martellaro. And this week, my guest is Technical Community Facilitator, Jonathan Bernstein. Jonathan, welcome.
Thanks for having me, John.
Hey, it's nice to have you on the show. You were introduced to me by Phil Shapiro, who was on the show recently, and we've been getting to get to know each other. And I am fascinated by your ability to use your communication skills and your technical skills to bring people and technology and government together. And we're going to get into that in the second half of the show. It's amazing. So thank you for joining me.
All I can say is you light me up, so I much appreciate it.
Yeah, absolutely. So in the first half of the show, we typically get into the guest background, and I was fascinated by yours, as I am by just about everybody's, and I hope the listeners are too. In your case, you were born in New London, near Groton, Connecticut, the home of the Electric Boat Company. That sounds kind of weird, but that's the company that makes nuclear submarines. The reason I'm fascinated is because I used to want to work on a nuclear submarine when I was growing up. So,
the first thing, John, is it's Groton, not Groton, so you give yourself away.
An outsider.
You know, there's so many towns where you got to get the pronunciation local. Isn't it funny?
Okay, I've been rectified, energized, purified.
Anyway, so I think the story that I told is that my brother, I have one brother who's a year and a half older than I am, and there's a place on the road in southern Connecticut where when the nuclear subs are launched from Electric Boat there, General Dynamics, you can see them come out. And it was only a handful of times that we saw this, but as young boys, we were just intrigued. Now, it turns out my brother went to physician's assistant school, and so he's much more on the real science side, you know? I think, if anything, what I learned from it about me is that I seem to be interested, John, in anything I don't know about.
Well, you got a partner in crime, because I do the same thing. But, you know, having an open mind and learning about things that you're not necessarily an expert in certainly does do wonders for your enthusiasm and excitement and being an all-around educated person. So, and that's what you are. So, cool.
Well, that's a nice way to look at it, for certain.
So, what were your early influences? Was it parents? School?
Yeah, very much. My father was a rabbi in rural Connecticut. He left Germany right before the Second World War. And so he was very sort of European, you know. He was highly educated, spoke six languages.
Six?
Languages. But the thing about it that I really remember is that he would interact with anybody regardless of education or station. So I can't help but think that one of the influences that came from him was the notion of basically having respect for anybody and recognizing that everybody has value. And it's a shame that I kind of even have to say that these days, but it seems like I wish it were more common. Now my mother was actually a pediatrician. She was a doctor, and she went to medical school when women just didn't really do that. She was trained as a pediatrician, but for many years she worked at the Connecticut State Health Department. She supervised all of the maternal and child health programs there. And for any of your listeners who know about the WIC program, Women, Infants, Children, that is a food program, she was instrumental in bringing WIC to Connecticut. And so she was an amazing innovator. But she also lent this idea of cooperation as a way of being successful and public service. Anyway, I think one story that I remember that was so funny is that when we were in high school, we would come home and my brother and I would be full of excitement about, you know, the dissections that we had just done, you know, the serious biology stuff. Mm-hmm. And my mother was just intrigued by this. She loved this, and she wanted to encourage it. But the memory that I have is that my father, for all of his worldliness, he was not a clinician, John. And the more we talked about this, the more pale his face would become until he would say, "Can we talk about something else?"
Well, I can see the seeds right away of your personality because of your parents. Part theologian, part doctor, part scientist. Cool. So in the end, though, you ended up becoming, of all things, a lawyer. Tell me, how did you get from parents who was a rabbi and a pediatrician to becoming interested in law?
Well, you know, it's funny that one thing that happens to many children is they may admire their parents, but in adolescence, push against, so don't automatically gravitate, you know, toward the careers of their parents. It's pretty interesting in the sense of looking back. Anybody looking at me with my kind of a little bit of intellectual bent, you know, could say, "Why didn't you become a rabbi?" Or at the same time, with the clinical kind of interest that I have, even though it's as a generalist now, of why not going into medicine? Well, I haven't thought much about that, John, but can't help that might be part of it.
That didn't happen to me. My dad was in the Army and was in teletype communications, and there were slide rules around the house and radio parts, and so I sort of glommed onto that. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Anyway, I ended up going to college at the University of Vermont in Burlington, Vermont, and there I studied history and political science, and it was a great college experience. But at the point when people are then thinking what to do next, my brother, who was a year ahead of me in college, and as I mentioned, he was headed toward PA school, physician's assistant school, said to me, "Well, why don't you take the LSATs?" So it was really out of a lack of kind of anything else to do. I took the LSATs, did reasonably well on them, and thought, well, law school would be sort of an interesting training for what I assumed would be kind of other things. In other words, I never really thought I'd end up doing anything that looked like the practice of law.
Tell me about the LSAT. What is that? Is that sort of a qualification test for law school?
Sure. It's like the MedCats or one that, you know, it's the standardized test.
Okay. So if you do well on that, that's the score on which you get admitted to law school?
Well, along with your college credentials, sure.
Sure, yeah.
And so I ended up going to law school in Madison, Wisconsin, at University of Wisconsin-Madison. And interestingly enough, what was going on then was a big emphasis on interdisciplinary studies and work. And I just drank that up. There were people who, you know, we would take a contracts class, a traditional law school class, but apart from the emphasis on how to interpret contracts and how to write them and legal principles, what I got was a dose of why do people enter into contracts and what's the underlying psychological dynamic? And don't people have a reason to trust the people on the other side? And in most instances, isn't the handshake much more important than the written contract? So I love that stuff. Now, again, never any idea what the heck would come from it. But it made law school pretty interesting for me.
Did you find law school challenging, or did you kind of... You're a pretty smart guy. Did you kind of breeze through it?
Well, I wouldn't say at all that I breezed through it, but I think what happened to me, I think it strikes me that at that time in my law school, there were a fair number of people who weren't going to law school right out of college. And these were people who had been in the workforce for, you know, several years. And I really admired them because they were very organized in a way that I wasn't. But at the same time, in college, I had sort of gotten progressively more serious about academics as the years went on. And so in my senior year in college was the most rigorous of anything, you know, in terms of my college career. So by the, when the next fall I got to law school, I think it's fair to say I was kind of ready to be challenged. Did it challenge? Yes, but I don't remember, you know, being overwhelmed by it.
If you've taught yourself how to learn and you've got good work habits, you're in really good shape.
Well, I would say I think I
that's
wasn't
one of the
so
strong. My wife's a professor, and she has constant stories to tell me about how the students haven't taught themselves how to learn, and that's a key part of the education process, I think. It's sort of a mental process where you go through with the techniques and the discipline and what you need to do to learn. And it's an art form, and a lot of students never grasp it.
Well, you know, it's interesting you say that, because the way I would translate that is that if you get into an immersive style of learning, you're likely to be successful. And that, I think, is what worked for me, meaning that this material really interested me. And so it was relatively easy for me to immerse myself in it. I mean, I was lucky at that point that I didn't have to work on the side, because that would have, I don't know if I would have been up to it in that case. In any event, that I think is what I can remember about it, that, you know, that let me be reasonably successful. Not so much with a kind of a business curriculum. I took a tax class only because people whose opinion I respected said that I should, even though I didn't expect it to practice that. And of course, I liked that, because in tax law, the problems were all very discrete. So even if it was complicated, I didn't find it so complicated.
So your inspirations were within the academic curriculum. Sometimes people are inspired by movies or TV shows like Star Trek. Sometimes people are inspired by people they've met or teachers. But you were inspired by the curriculum itself, the psychology of contracts and taxes. Interesting.
Well, I think this came from my father, in the sense that he was the ultimate sort of intellectual, the person who sort of seized on ideas. And yeah. I think I must have gotten a dose of that.
Was there a dose of theology along with it, in terms of informing your values and contracts and human relations?
Yes, but it was more of a holistic theology. Mm-hmm. Not a kind of a rigid theology.
More of an outreach type of thing, and service to each other and things like that.
Well, just to take as an example, that long before it was cool, my father in his rural congregation was doing interfaith services, you know, for Thanksgiving and a couple of other times of year. And the local priests and ministers were his close friends. So, you know, I think all of this was, again, what he saw through his life experience and his training is something that Obama has kept tried to tell everyone that nobody got, of the commonality that we have, that if we choose to emphasize, we can, rather than seizing always on the differences.
Excellent. Yep, I agree. I think this is a good time to take a break. When we come back, I want to ask you about your career as an attorney and then some of the things you're doing nowadays. Folks, we'll be back in 60 seconds. Stay with us.
Hello there, all you fabulous Background Mode listeners. I'm Kelly Gamont with the Mac Observer, and I just want to say a few words about how you can support all the things we do. If you're thinking about buying something from Apple, Amazon, or Mac Mall, just go to the Mac Observer's homepage, where we have a section called Support TMO. or you can just enter macobserver.com/Apple Store, all one word, and that will take you to our special page for Apple and our other affiliates. If you make a purchase from one of our partners this way, the Mac Observer receives a small compensation for sending business their direction. Pretty cool, right? And you don't pay a penny more. This small fee from our affiliates helps us continue to bring you TMO's daily news, reviews, tips, how-tos, and podcasts like this one. So the next time you're thinking about an online purchase, come to TMO's homepage and support the Mac Observer. Thanks. Back to you, John.
We're back. I'm chatting with Jonathan Bernstein.
So, John, can I ask you something?
Absolutely.
I know Kelly Gumont.
Well, we all do. She's delightful.
She made a presentation to our Pi group about 1Password.
Was it in person? Because she lives in Oregon and you were in Maryland.
No, it was remote. It was,
Yeah, she's so cool. She writes for us, and we do podcasting together. Typically, we're on Jeff Gamet's
Daily Observations. You will have to please say hello to her for me.
I will. So we're back to you. So you were out of law school. You had an interesting first job for a lot of attorneys.
Well, I had clerked for a judge at what's called the U.S. Court of Claims, and these were all adjudication of contract claims against the U.S. government. And the judge that I worked for was retiring after I had been clerking for him for, I guess, about a year and a half. And he retired to a small law firm off of DuPont Circle in Washington. And so that's where I followed him, and I did some writing for him. But at that time, he told me about the FEC, the Federal Election Commission. I had then been unsuccessful, really walking around on Capitol Hill looking for a committee staff job. And those are really prize jobs for lawyers, and I wasn't successful doing that. And so when the judge mentioned to me the FEC, the Federal Election Commission, I thought to myself, I can't walk on the Hill, but I can regulate the members of Congress. So anyway, I ended up as a lawyer just less than 2 years out of law school, going to work for the Federal Election Commission, which is one of the few independent agencies with an even number of members.
Has there been any changes recently?
No. And as for most things, John, there is a cynical explanation for that and a non-cynical explanation. And the cynical explanation is if you have an agency that regulates members of Congress as candidates, then you don't want it to be too aggressive, right?
Right, or members get replaced, right?
But the non-cynical explanation is that there probably isn't a more sensitive area for a government agency to regulate. And so perhaps there is some wisdom in requiring, in essence, bipartisan agreement for investigations and such to go forward.
Yes. Yes. Awesome. I like that. Well, as a FEC attorney, you were becoming very technical. And these were the days when you were moving from, as you told me before, dumb terminals to PCs on the desktop. And that sort of launched your technical career with PCs, right?
Right. At the time, when we got PCs, I think I already had my old Mac SE at home, and I never felt the need to sort of replicate the platform that I had at work at home. It always seemed to work pretty well, using these different things. But it was hilarious that I don't think my agency was alone at having these dumb terminals. I still remember that we had a presidential fellow who came, who finally embarrassed everyone, the commissioners and the appropriators, to get us these desktop PCs. But, you know, once we got the PCs, well, one memory I have, and the sad thing is how this hasn't really changed much, is that the IT shop then trained us. And you can easily see that we were using Windows NT, I think, at the time. And so there was a PC user access password. There was an NT password. We were using then Lotus Notes for messaging, and so there was a Lotus Notes password. And I'm forgetting, I think, a couple of other ones. So the original IT device was telling all of the users around the building to use a different password for each of these sign-ons. Well, within a couple within a couple of weeks, the IT department was completely overwhelmed with people who couldn't remember their passwords. And, of course, then they had to back off to let people know that, well, yes, you can use the same password for all these things, but please just change it now and then. And it's sad of how much has changed in technology and not so much that.
You guys were probably famous for launching the yellow sticky in the desk drawer, right?
And at the time, you know, where we used Lotus Notes, I was never trained as a coder. I have only the briefest memory of Fortran in my high school, you know, of having printouts come out of that. With Lotus Notes, it was good, though, that I could interact with our IT shop. And there was a woman that I really liked who was one of the developers. And I could try to script something, you know, to automatically. You can imagine that which you can do with rules and macros these days, then you had to script if I wanted to change, you know, to automatically have an email go into my calendar or something like that. And so what I could do is write something and then send it to her. And then she was tickled that I would even try and fix it and send it back. And so it let me do very primitive things. But I guess I would say to not be afraid of the, you know, HTML and code and technical stuff, even if there wasn't really, you know, that much I could do with it.
You know, I was in an organization like that. I'm not going to name it, but in my past, I was in a government organization where it was sufficient for most people to just go with what they had. And if you were smart and you were curious, you could, right away you'd learn things right and left. You'd learn scripting and HTML, and you'd learn, you know, web browsers, and you'd learn how Popmail works, and you learn about the internet, and all of a sudden you were pushing the edges. And it was really cool, and it was a lot of learning and fun. But there are all these people who were irritated by this, and, you know, upsetting the apple cart, and you know, things have to be done a certain way, and you're annoying us.
Well, that's reminding me.
Mac. You and your darn Mac.
No. Some of the early stories. You know, this reminds me, John, that we all assumed when we got PCs that the elemental point was now we could customize the PC to our part of the practice.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that we were finally out of the one size fits all. But that wasn't the idea of the IT shop.
No, not at all.
So it was very difficult to get them to okay any alteration that we wanted, you know, to make. In those days, we used to... We called the support user hostile.
Well, it got so bad in that organization I was referring to that they would do a spin meaning a pre-canned configuration of the operating system, and they'd roll it out to each desktop user, and they would have monitoring tools. And if you added unauthorized software or changed the system, they would detect it and tell your boss, and then you would get written up with a letter of reprimand for modifying your PC. It was terrible.
Yeah, see, well, my approach was far, far less, I think, controversial, but it was a joke that here I'm the lawyer, I'm the supervisor, and I'm the one who's coaching my colleagues and my team members of how you have to save your normal dot and your configuration, because otherwise, once a full, you know, rollout of an upgrade takes place, it'll all be wiped away.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it was just a hoot that I seemed to be the person who knew this and had to help people.
Yeah, I know the drill. I went down that road myself. Well, we're going to have to move on here.
Sure.
So I wanted to ask you about your work with the Washington Apple Pie. You are a board member and doing some interesting things. Tell me about the evolution of Washington Apple Pie and your work on the board and some of the initiatives that Washington Apple Pie is doing that I didn't know you were doing.
Sure. Well, the pie goes back to 1978. And so it's not too long after Apple came into being that there was a need for programs and for the distribution of programs. And so the pie was around and had a high point of more than 5,000 members. Now, the funny thing is, when journalists come at this, they say, well, you had 5,000 members then, and now you have 350. You know, well, what's going on? And you know what I say? That the former was, quote, before the internet. And it really is true that at that time and for many years, if you wanted to get any programs or learn how to do anything, you know, there was no Google. You had to go talk to people and be in a group. And what's wonderful about that is that, you know, Walt Mossberg, the All Things D and now Recode. Mm-hmm. So Walt lives in the metro area. And when he last talked to the Pie last year and gave a wonderful testimonial of how his whole technology beat, you know, what is his career, came from Apple IIs at Washington Apple Pie.
I grew up with Apple IIs. Yep. I know the history of that. Yep.
So,
and people who are older tend to socialize a little bit more. I've noticed it in a mug that I go to here in Denver once in a while, that there is still that interest in, you know, getting to meet people, socializing, gathering, as opposed to thumbing out messages and iMessage and internet access. There is still that social part, but that I can understand how the internet has kind of diluted people's ability to or need or interest in socializing when there's so much socializing right now with social media. So are you stabilized at 350, or is it okay at that level?
We have a lot of money in the bank, and one of the things we did several years ago was move out of the office that we were maintaining. And the joke about that, John, is that we run a digital photo contest, and we've been doing that for a number of years. And when we had the office, we would actually print out the winning photographs with big, big prints, and we'd post them on the walls of the office. Well, it got to the point where I had to admit, because I was a big fan of us doing that, that just being able to post the winning of the photo contest wasn't enough of a justification to keep the office that we didn't use very much. So anyway, we got out of what was a very hefty annual rent for that office to a place now where we rent space in a local Unitarian church for our classroom space. And it's a great partnership we have there. And it has taken a lot of the load off of our, you know, budget.
Is that what's allowed you to offer that scholarship that she told me about?
Well, we, you know, they actually, some of the earlier stewards of the pie did a good job saving money. So at the point where we moved out of our office, we were still sitting on a big pot of money in the bank that we weren't really using. And the way the scholarship arose, we have a board member who is on the faculty at George Mason University. And basically, you know, there is an argument that all the good ideas come from wives. You know, there's that strand. Well, his wife said to him, why doesn't the pie do a scholarship? And of course, Larry Kirschberg is his name, and he brought it up at a pie board meeting. And I am so proud of all of the other board members for seeing immediately that this was something very worthwhile to do. That you know, none of us really know how long the pie is going to be there. And the fact is, it basically sent out, you know, between a third and a half of the money that we had saved that we really weren't doing anything with. So George Mason did a very nice press release, and I'm still convinced that we are probably the only mug that actually has endowed a scholarship.
That's very cool. That's very cool.
Oh, I think there was one other story I wanted to tell about the classroom facilities at the Unitarian Church. Mm-hmm. And that is that when we first moved into the space for our some of our informal meetings, we were having trouble with the Wi-Fi. This was Wi-Fi that was broadcast from a central area and that didn't reach very far. And while they had repeaters, it just wasn't very good. And the challenge for us is that being a computer club, we kind of need some robust connectivity.
Did you switch to a mesh network?
No, it turned out, even better. It turned out that the church had a long delayed plan to roll Ethernet down the corridor where our classroom stuff was, but they just hadn't really done it. So what we did was to say to them, we will subsidize you doing that for all of the space down there, including ours, on condition that you do it right away. And this was an offer too good for them to refuse. So out of that, with investment of a couple of $1,000s that was easy for us, or less than that, I think, we now have Ethernet in the classroom that we plug our own airport into, so we generate our own Wi-Fi. And in that space, there's no need for a mesh network. In other spaces, don't get me started. Yes.
One of the things that impressed me about you when we first met was your background and your history and turning that into the ability to work with people and technology to make things happen. And you're doing some things with community and government that I've never heard of, and they're just amazing. So one of the things that fascinates me about you when I first got to know you was your unique ability, because of your history, to bring together people and technology and government and get things going and interact. And you're doing some things that I had never heard of when we first talked. Tell me more about that.
Well, there's several different sort of organizations and activities that I'm now involved in. And let me start with the Citizens Advisory Board. So in the county where we live, there are what they call these voluntary boards that are set up. And a basket of them around the county are hyper-local. And so because I live in Silver Spring, Maryland, I'm on this Silver Spring Citizens Advisory Board. And it's an interface, a group that provides advice and counseling to the county executive and the local county council, you know, the two layers of elected officials that we have. And what's wonderful about it is it lets me stir the pot in the community. So our very role in this is occasionally to interact with some of the county agencies. So, you know, our county parks department wants to try out their vision for the future, so they come to one of the meetings that I, you know, the subcommittee meeting that I held at the end of January. Or another one is it really lets us interact with the local transportation people. So we're in a place, John, that used to be a pure car suburb and now is urbanizing. So in the local Department of Transportation are traditional traffic engineers. And as recently as probably 5 to 7 years ago, whenever anyone around the table would mention pedestrian or bikes, they would titter, you know? Well, they have new leadership, and now they're installing bike lanes all over the downtown, and they want input from us continually. And so there's a woman who's a manager there, who in the old way would never have even wanted to talk to me. But in the new way, no matter what I send her, she almost always says, thanks for doing this.
Well, that's what's fascinating to me about what you're doing is that we don't often hear about this. There is available a mechanism and an opportunity for local government to have adult conversations with local citizens in a constructive way. And what you're doing and what we don't hear about much in modern society is exactly that, is using technology and communication and internet technologies and tools to open up that dialogue between thoughtful adults in the community and local government leaders. And you do that in a way that I had never seen emphasized so much. I mean, we're all so busy messing around with our computers and using them for other technical means. But this is an excellent way to use our communication tools, and it's fascinating to me. And it's a good lesson for the listeners.
Well, it's a lesson on many levels, but one of them that I'd like to emphasize is it's a real antidote to cynicism. And I still remember that before I got on the board, I trolled the county website that had correspondence, and I would see that this board writes letters to the county executive and the county council. But what really impressed me were the responses, because we would actually get responses from the executive and from the county council members thanking us for our input and talking about the substantive issues that we write about. Mm-hmm. And if what you do is, come to these meetings where the county officials show up and they really want to know what the community thinks, it really is an antidote to the kind of the skepticism in the modern life where people think I'm powerless.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, I think we're about out of time. And
oh my.
So we've been just chewing up 37 minutes here, and it's been a grand tour, and this has been delightful. There's so much more to talk about. I wish we had more time to delve into it, but alas, we do not. So I want to thank you for sharing your history with us and your inspirations and how you came to be working on what you're working on now. And listeners, this is an important lesson. There are infrastructures, there's mechanisms, there's community, there's ways to get in touch with your local government leaders who, as Jonathan said, want to hear what people are thinking, and working in concert with the community and government, a lot of things can get done, and you can roll up your sleeves and make changes that are local and constructive. So this is great stuff. I will put in the show notes some links to Jonathan. How would you like to be contacted if the listeners want to get a hold of you right away?
Well, my Twitter handle is DC Campfin. Did I give that to you? I think so.
Yeah, I have it. I'll put it in the show notes.
And you can actually put in the show notes my PI email address.
Okay.
Which is do you have that? .Bernstein@WAP.org.
Mm-hmm. Cool. I will do that. And
you know what I'll also do, John, is I will email you with just the essentials of some of the other groups that it pains me that I didn't get to. Our Time Bank, our Makerspace, our Fenton Village, our TweetUps. Oh, my God.
I'd like to talk to you about that some more. Maybe you can do an encore performance with me some point in the future.
I would love that.
All right. That'd be cool. Folks, for coming by, thanks for listening very much. We appreciate your listening to Background Mode, as always. We'll see you next week.